Hi there, Jonathan here. The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website where you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. That's at www.jonathanfaust.com. Thank you and enjoy. A good friend of mine over the weekend was telling me he was designing a retreat for engineers, a mindfulness retreat for engineers, and asked me if I had any advice. It can be a challenging crowd. I said, well, the first thing you have to do is identify the extroverted engineers. He said, how do I do that? I said, they'll be the ones looking at your shoes. So I hope it's okay if I start off this talk with a potentially offensive and sexist joke. There's no politically correct way to set this one up, but I thought it was interesting. It was entitled, Why Men Should Not Write Advice Columns. Dear John, I hope you can help me. The other day, I set off for work, leaving my husband in the house watching TV. My car stalled, and then it broke down about a mile down the road. I had to walk back to get my husband's help. When I got home, I couldn't believe my eyes. He was in our bedroom with the neighbor's daughter. I'm 32, my husband is 34, and the neighbor's daughter is 19. We've been married for 10 years. When I confronted him, he broke down and admitted they've been having an affair for the last 6 months. He won't go to counseling, and I'm afraid I'm a wreck and need advice urgently. Could you please help? Sincerely, Sheila. Dear Sheila, a car stalling after being driven a short distance can be caused by a variety of faults with the engine. Start by checking so there's no debris in the fuel line. If it is clear, check the vacuum pipes and the hoses on the intake manifold, and also check all grounding wires. It goes on from there. So when it comes to answering life's important questions, it's important you're lined up with a system that has the right perspective. And we've been talking about what are called the 10 perfections in Buddhist psychology, which are 10 qualities that you can reflect on and polish, that are really aspects of someone who's living a fully awake life. And tonight we're going to talk about the 10th, which is considered the fruit of the practice, and it's referred to as equanimity or serenity. And this is really kind of a byproduct of meditation practice. So just to review very quickly, that the sense of equanimity, when it's all said and done, it's kind of what the practice is all about. It's not about being detached or aloof, but it is, here's how it's described, a mind filled with equanimity is abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, and without ill will. And so how do we cultivate this in our practice? And one of the ways, many different skillful means of developing that capacity for immeasurable well-being, is by reflecting on these 10 perfections, of reflecting on your actions and your speech and your thoughts in regard to these 10. And just very quickly, the first is generosity. When you cultivate a generous heart, you move out of a small self into more of a relational self. To reflect on your moral behavior, that your actions are really aligned with your highest intentions. to reflect on renunciation, of living a simple life that isn't complicated, that really allows you to cultivate wisdom and insight. When you're not needlessly distracted, you've got more availability to really look at the nature of reality, to see clearly, to really assess your energy. Can you bring more energy and vigor and vitality into your life? You know, how are you leaking energy? How could you apply all of your energy to what's most important? And as you're cultivating energy, to also cultivate patience, to realize that change and transformation takes time. And part of that as well is the seventh of these, which is cultivating truthfulness and being honest. It's one thing to see clearly, it's another to speak truth. The eighth is determination and resolution, to stay with what you know to be most important, to stick to it. And the ninth is learning how to explore the development of the heart of loving kindness. And there's a difference between the intellectual knowing of these qualities and the actual embodied practice. It's kind of the difference between like reading a menu and actually having the meal. So you can recognize that yes, generosity is important, but the experience of writing a check or giving someone some money directly is that embodied experience. The only way you can know it is by deeply engaging. So when you arrive in the present moment into that state of equanimity or serenity, it's kind of coming in contact with who you really are. There are different ways of describing it. Sometimes it's described as just the absence of what are called the defilements, you know, the absence of greed, the absence of hatred, the absence of confusion. When those three energies are gone, what you're left with is like pure awareness, clear, sunny skies. Sometimes it's described as awake awareness, that you are awake and you're aware that you are awake. Sometimes it's described as compassionate presence, that you're awake, but it's not a detached awake. It's actually an engaged awake. So you could say that when you experience serenity, when you experience that equanimity or steadiness, that's your true nature. That's who you really are in your essence. So as I've thought about how to talk about this, I think the best way to think of it is kind of like the hero's journey. That there's a call that you experience. There's something, you know that you're something beyond just the weather systems of your mind, and that it calls you engage into practice. And then there's the journey. As you look closely at your life, you begin to see more clearly into the nature of reality. And then there's the arrival. There are those moments, those glimpses, when you begin to really sense who and what you truly are. And then there's something around we could kind of call post-awakening. Because every one of us I know have had moments of deep insight, moments of just sensing the mystery. And then the question becomes, how do you remember when you re-engage in your life? So as I was reflecting about kind of how often we get caught in our moods, I was reminded of many, many years ago, my father was a college professor, and on one of his sabbaticals, he and my mother bought a Volkswagen camper van, one of those Westphalia vans in Europe, and they spent about 8 months traveling around in Europe. And at the kind of the tail end of summer, I was with them for about a month in Great Britain. And so they were really into going into old abbeys and looking at old architecture. And so I remember this one particular is this vast home that some coal baron owned. We were given a tour of the house, and there were a very, very formal house. And there was a sitting room between the two wings where the master of the house and the mistress of the house had their own wings. And they would sort of rendezvous in the morning. And I don't know why I remember this, but as they were showing us this, you know, there were these there's this formal sitting room with these pillows, and the wife would set up a pillow, and if the pillow was like horizontal, it meant she was in a bad mood and stay away. And if it was upright, it meant that she was in a good mood and they could be together. And then there was a suggestion, there was another pillow, and when that pillow was placed in a particular way, there was, shall we say, the suggestion of the possibility of propagating the species. So we all have these moods. That was really the first, most formal expression of mood I'd ever seen. And if you've ever seen, like, small children, how many weather systems can pass through? You know, because it's all so unfiltered, there can be, you know, this horrible tantrum mood followed by, like, a joyous mood just seconds later. So I actually Googled a list of how many moods are there. And there are a lot of moods. I'll give you the positive moods, A through E. Amused, blissful, calm, cheerful, content, dreamy, ecstatic, energetic, and excited. The negative moods, A through F. Angry, annoyed, apathetic, bad, cranky, depressed, envious, frustrated. And it's an interesting reflection. How many moods do you think you've experienced today? How many different states do you imagine pass through? Or what would you say were like your top three today? There's always a moment in practice for myself, but I also notice in intensive retreats, there's this amazing moment when you realize that you're not your mood, when you realize that you're not your thought. You don't have to believe your thoughts. You don't have to believe your moods. And it's the difference between being angry and being with your anger. That little switch is the key to being a lot more skillful in your life. But it really points toward what liberation is. So the moods are like weather systems, and the moods are generally dependent on something external. Coffee tends to put me in a good mood. Too much coffee puts me in a bad mood. Sugar can get you in a really good mood, but then you know what happens after you eat sugar. Getting what you want puts you in a good mood. Getting what you don't want in a bad mood. And most of the time, it's all external stuff. Your car won't start, bad mood. Someone sends you a thank you note, good mood. Someone cuts you off on the highway, your tax bill is smaller than expected. We live in constant reaction to the externals and to our moods. And in an unexamined life, we're nothing more than a pinball in a pinball machine, constantly reacting. And of course, our whole life is designed around the desire for certain things. and avoiding other things. We have a desire for success. We have a desire for health. We have a desire for love. We have a desire to be respected. And we have a real fear of failure and a fear of sickness, a fear of shame, a fear of blame. And unless we look closely, we are real victims of all those external elements. And then the question, of course, is there a state of happiness that is not dependent on externals? Is that possible? And that's what points to this 10th perfection of equanimity and serenity and steadiness, is the possibility that you can be happy no matter what the externals are in your life. And so we set off on this journey to see more clearly. And the question is enlightenment a blinding flash that's permanent? Or is it a gradual awakening, kind of a process of gradual awakening? I've had flashes of wonderful insights in my life and in my practice. I've had moments when I felt there was a quality of arriving and like a really beautiful state. But I have to say, for me, it's been gradual. And I think for most people it is. Pema Chodron often talks of how she was always jealous of people who have breakthroughs. And it's only until she realized that when she looks back, she can tell there's a difference. If she looks back over the last year, she's a little more free than she was the year before. And it can be very, very helpful when you inevitably find yourself frustrated with your practice, just to ask yourself, how has life changed since you started? And chances are good that if you look back 6 months or a year, there may be a little more equanimity, a little more spaciousness, a little less reactivity in your life. When I first started practicing, there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. You know, lots of insights I could see, different ways, you know, things I was believing that obviously weren't true once I really took the time to look at them. The first month-long retreat I went off to was just filled with revelations, 30 days of silence. And 2 years later, I went back to do another month-long retreat, and I must confess I had some expectations. And it was kind of meh. You know, there were some things I really got that were helpful, but like no big drama. And so I kind of returned home and kind of re-engaged. But it was about maybe 2 months later when my wife Tara said, you know, you're a lot less anxious. And then when I thought about it, I realized that something had shifted. I was just a little bit less caught in fear and anxiety. I always like to quote Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, who had this really silly phrase. But he said, you water the root and enjoy the fruit. That any time you practice non-judging awareness, present moment non-judging awareness, you're watering something very, very deep. And while it may not be instantly tangible and some great insight, inevitably there is some quality of recognizing this quality of presence. Anytime you pause, you tap into what Deepak Chopra calls that field of infinite possibility. It may be a microsecond, but a lot can happen in a microsecond. So one of the elements that we speak of in meditation is this idea of the witness, the sense of who you are as the non-judging observer. So let's just do a short reflection, if you don't mind. A little 45-second Zen pop quiz. So as you close your eyes and as you feel your breath, and as we're reflecting on this quality of serenity, a quality of steadiness that's free of externals, you might just take a moment and reflect on what can be a very helpful doorway, a helpful portal to touch into this. And it's to reflect on someone or something that you hold with gratitude or appreciation. In your life right now, what are you most grateful for? What do you most appreciate? And as you deepen your breath, can you locate what that feels like inside? And just for a few moments, can you sense what's sometimes called the seat of the witness, of your capacity to observe without judgment? And can you imagine a state that is not dependent on externals? That awake, aware, and non-judging. And if you like, you can deepen your breath. And if you like, you can open your eyes or feel free to remain with them closed. So it's been said that this practice is really a twofold practice. When you're practicing meditation or mindfulness or non-judging awareness, the first element is to be aware of what's happening as it's happening. So you're aware of the in-breath as the in-breath is happening. You're aware of the sounds as they're happening. You're aware of a feeling of sadness as it's happening. So that's the first part of practice, that moment-to-moment recognition of what's right here. The second part of this definition is to be aware of your relationship to what is happening. And that's where the liberation stuff comes in. That you might be aware of sadness as sadness is happening, but then to be aware of your reaction to it, of wanting to make it go away, or wanting to hold on to it. That capacity to observe without judgment is where the freedom lies. It's not the events that are happening in your life that are so critical. It's how you're holding them. It's the attitude you cultivate internally. That's where the freedom is. The experience of equanimity, that sense of steadiness, reveals how you are relating to your experience. And what I've noticed in my own practice, when I really pay attention to that moment-to-moment awareness of what's happening, is like there's a needle, and the needle moves from I like it, I don't like it. Every little thing, there's some internal little gauge that's either pushing away or grasping. It's a fascinating practice, and there are some retreats that you can do, which I've mentioned before, where the entire retreat in silence, you're simply observing how you're reacting to the present moment. And it's fascinating to see even a thought will have a subtle quality of aversion or a subtle quality of attraction. And how for each of us, it's subjective. For some, the traffic outside could be really irritating. For others, the sound is comforting. As they say, if you hang on to something, you're going to get rope burn. If you can let it go, there's a quality of freedom. So part of the journey is about training your awareness. The concentration practices are very powerful to bring yourself back. Oh, I'm lost in thought again. Let me come back to the here and now. The more you practice concentration, the more you will develop a steadiness in the midst of all the fluctuations in your life. You'll begin to recognize that portal of coming back to the here and now, like resetting or rebooting. There are also practices that have to do with developing non-judging awareness, that sense of the witness, to be aware of what is changing. Tremendously powerful. Tremendously powerful. And that's where what many people find as they practice meditation, that with all the energies that are coming at you, you're a little bit less reactive. If you're not aware, there's stimulus and immediately there's a response. And what happens as you develop this practice is there's stimulus, a little space, and then the response. And that's the difference between yelling back at someone out of reaction and pausing and sensing their suffering and perhaps being a little more compassionate in your response. And then there are also the practices of just letting go and letting be. As we explored at the end, the last couple minutes of that meditation, the invitation was, if you let go of effort, what happens? And it's also about training your attention to simply allow things to be as they are. That span is very, very helpful. The concentration practices are willful. They help you to arrive. The witnessing practices help you to be more aware of the flow and the stream and how you're relating to it. And then there are the surrender practices. And in all of these, sometimes there are these beautiful moments when three things are no longer operative. There's no greed. There's this absence of desire. There's no hatred. There's an absence of aversion or pushing away. And there's the absence of confusion. There's just simply a clear sense of this moment just as it is. And those moments of arriving are wonderful. The challenge, of course, is that oftentimes when we sit down to meditate, we're kind of gunning for those experiences. And why it's very helpful to remind yourself when you sit down to meditate that it's not about arriving in some exalted state of consciousness, rather than just being fully present. Those moments seem to come in their own time. But we've all had them. And so when we talk about arriving in this sense of equanimity or steadiness or serenity, this is sort of the part of the talk where I talk about moments of spiritual awakening and seeing into true nature. And I thought of sort of telling some stories from my own practice. But then I started to look online. Like, are there some like really juicy, pithy stories of awakening and presence that I could share with you? And the problem with, there are many, many stories of people talking about, you know, spiritual awakening. The only problem with those stories is they all sound like they're stoned out of their gourds. Here are a few lines. I saw a tree blooming in the parking lot, and it was as if I had never seen a tree before in my life. It appeared to be glowing, shining, pulsating, radiating energy and beauty. I could feel it was alive, breathing the same air as me, moving to the same energy and life force. It was as if I did not exist. There was no ego, no me, no boundaries. I was part of everyone and everything, and we are all part of everything. I also realized I was tiny, absolutely minuscule in the largest, most vast and unknowable universe. There are others, but they're hard to relate to. And at the same time, I know that all, if not many of us, have had moments of experiencing something that we could simply call a mystery. When this tightly bound sense of self has either fallen away or gotten very porous, where time and space open up, and there is a presence which is very, very hard to translate, but it's there. I remember reading in college a book entitled Mysticism by a writer called by the name of Evelyn Underhill. And he was describing mystics all through the ages of, you know, different cultures and different ages, and looking at their writing and trying to find what's common among all of these mystics, some famous, some not so famous. And it was quite evident in reading these that they had all had the same experience. They had all had this transcendent experience of no self. And as they were articulating it, they were articulating it through their culture, through their upbringing, through their language, through their religious beliefs. But I think what those qualities have in common is sort of the absence, again, the absence of certain things. There's an absence of a self, an absence of a conditioned self. Again, there's an absence of desire, an absence of judgment, and an absence of confusion. So how do we cultivate this quality of equanimity? There are a few phrases that can be helpful little reminders, and perhaps we can do a short little meditation once again. If you'd like, you can close your eyes. As you reflect on this quality of equanimity and serenity, you might just reflect on the following phrases, or you might repeat them internally. May I be balanced and at peace. And as you reflect on balance and peace, we acknowledge that all created things rise and pass away. Joys and sorrows, pleasant events, people, buildings, nations, whole civilizations. Is it possible to let yourself rest in the midst of this fact that all created things arise and fall away? May I learn to see the arising and passing of all nature with balance. May I be open and balanced and at peace. And here we recognize that all beings are heirs to their own karma, that their lives arise and pass away following the conditions and the deeds that created them. And while you can deeply love and care for others, in the end, their happiness and suffering depends on their thoughts and their actions. And to find equanimity with others, you can reflect on these phrases. Your happiness and suffering depend on your thoughts and actions, and not my wishes for you. If there is someone who comes into mind, you might reflect on these phrases. May you see the arising and passing of all things with equanimity and balance. May you be balanced and at peace. And as you reflect on bringing this field of equanimity to the whole world, you might reflect on these phrases. May I bring compassion and equanimity to the events of the world. May I find balance and equanimity and peace in this world. And you might imagine in these final moments the possibility of a quality of steadiness, a quality of balance, in the midst of all the changing, fluctuating events of these times we live in. To sense your capacity to wish yourself well, and those you love and care for, and all beings. May all find balance. May all find peace in the midst of change. And gently deepening your breath. When you're ready, you can open your eyes. Like many things, serenity and equanimity is not anything you can make happen. But what you can do is to cultivate the most optimal environment you can for that quality to emerge. All great systems have guidelines to support you, fundamentally your ethical behavior, to look at what it means to align your actions with your true intentions. Those who tend to be the most generous tend to have more compassion, more openness, more intimacy in their life. Those who live simply tend to be less distracted by externals, more aware of their own purpose, their own mission. Exploring how you manage your energy so that it helps you to move toward what's most important in your life. And to reflect on patience, on determination, on resilience. These qualities of the 10 perfections can be very, very helpful guides. They can be very powerful inquiries to simply ask, is my life aligned with what is most important? So there's a lot more I wanted to say, but I am calling on equanimity and allowing it to be totally fine. Thanks for your kind attention. A few announcements, actually a number of announcements. First of all, I'm going to be offering a day-long retreat this Saturday, and it's on the power of questions. And again, there are.